The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
For this September 2023 Sesshin, Alan and I have chosen a koan to work with. And actually, Alan chose it, and I heartily agreed. It's a beautiful koan from a collection called Entangling Vines. Now, this collection isn't a collection that we at Boundless Way Zen work with in our koan curriculum, but nonetheless, it's a beautiful koan with many, many pointers. And I'm going to read it for you right now. This is Case 18 from Entangling Vines, Shangu's Sweet Olive Blossoms. One day, the poet Shangu was visiting Huitang Zuxin. Huitang said, "You know the passage in which Confucius says, 'My friends, do you think I'm hiding things from you? In fact, I am hiding nothing from you.' Well, it's just the same with the great matter of Zen. Do you understand this?" "I don't understand," Shangu replied. Later, Huitang and Shangu were walking in the mountains where the air was filled with the scent of sweet olive blossoms. Huitang asked, "Do you smell the fragrance of the blossoms?" Shangu said, "I do." Huitang said, "You see, I'm hiding nothing from you." At that moment, Shangu was enlightened. 2 months later, he visited Sishin Wuxin. Sishin greeted him and said, "I'll die, and you'll die, and we'll end up burnt into two heaps of ashes. At that time, where will we meet?" Shangu tried to respond, but couldn't come up with anything. Later, while on the road to Quinan, he woke from a nap and suddenly understood Sishin's meaning. Thereafter, he attained the samadhi of perfect freedom. The 20th century Zen teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, once said that true teaching feels like it's something being forced upon you. I would add that true learning is tumultuous, chaotic, and grates upon you because it's rubbing up against those well-worn habits, the well-worn views, the beliefs that we hold unconsciously or consciously. In fact, I would say that true learning doesn't feel like learning at all. Typically, in our common day, when we learn something, say in school or through books or classes, it's more like instruction, information gathering. Building on that, true learning doesn't really arise until much later. And then we look back and say, oh. In this wonderful story, it's very interesting that a poet is the main character. In most koans that we work with, it's generally a monk, sometimes a hapless monk, or a teacher, Zen teacher, or maybe a government official, but a poet. I love that. And for me, it's because poets are folks who see things that aren't always obvious. Good poets, anyway. They see things at the periphery of life, and they have a capacity for reflection and maybe some distance. from the things that we are in the midst of and miss all the time. This story, this koan, is about this poet learning. And it's in three acts. The first act, the poet meets the Buddha Dharma, meets the teachings, meets the teaching in the form of words and text. Not the words and text of Buddhism or Zen, but the text of Confucius. So for those who don't recall high school history and high school world history, Confucius was a philosopher who lived in about 500 to 400 BCE in China. And his sayings were all captured by his great followers many, many years after in put into a set of rules and practices and that are often followed to this day. We certainly know and have heard some of Confucius's sayings. But it's perhaps not too surprising that a poet doesn't really connect with this. Sure, he knew who Confucius was and knew during this time much of what Confucius wrote. But to really connect, he could connect or understand on a logical level, but on a deep learning, a deep level, he didn't. I know this feeling quite well. I've opened our sutra books many times and read things and thought, you know, I just don't understand that. In fact, most of what I've read in the sutra book never leapt up to me as an understanding. It was only later in my life when something kind of connected or awoke, could I say, oh, that's what they were meaning. That's what they said. And that leads us to the second act of this story, where the poet and his teacher are off walking in the mountains, where he meets the teaching, the Buddha Dharma, through his sense gates. They're walking in the mountains, and his teacher says, "Do you smell the fragrance of blossoms?" "Yeah, how can you miss that?" And the teacher says, "See, I'm hiding nothing from you." And the poet gets it. He gets it because it's there. It's right there. However, you may be questioning or wondering what this teacher said about, "I'm hiding nothing from you." He says, "I'm hiding nothing from you." So there may be some confusion around the fact that how could a teacher hide a fragrance that's wafting out through the mountains? And this sort of reveals our duality, our split between self and other. When the fragrance is everywhere, you are everywhere. You are the fragrance. And the poet understands. And at that moment, he got it. He was enlightened. I know for a fact, though, if someone said to me, "Nothing is hidden," I would be a little confused. I know a couple days ago, I lost my keys. They were hidden from me, my car keys. They're looking for my car keys. Maybe you have a pet that hid your slippers or hid something valuable. Maybe you have a partner who hid something from you inadvertently. How it could be nothing is hidden. Well, in that moment, It's just, ah, where are my keys? Where are my slippers? Ah, the scent of olive blossoms. Right there, nothing hidden. Right there. In Act Three of this wonderful koan, the poet sees another, his teacher, Cixin Wuxin, and he greets him by saying, I'll die and you'll die, and we'll end up burnt into two heaps of ashes. And at that time, where will we meet? What? This definitely is a shocking, confusing statement. I'll die and you'll die, and we'll end up burnt into two heaps of ashes. At that time, where will we meet? So what does it mean to meet? The etymology of the word meeting from Middle English is mite, and it means to find out, to encounter, to see, to come into the same place. When we meet a teacher in Shoken, we aren't meeting to sit and talk about the weather or nod and agree upon everything. We're meeting, our meeting meets beyond space and time, right into this moment, the eternity of this moment. And then this thing about time. At that time, where will we meet? We'll end up burnt after death in two heaps of ashes. I would say that our view of time has been structured throughout our lives from the moment we could start putting sentences together and understanding. And time, although we don't always often see it this way, is a story. Now, I'm not making a metaphysical truth claim, and I'm not upending some sort of T as in time that exists in Einstein's equations and relativity and quantum mechanics. No, I'm talking about the lived experience of time. Conventionally, we see time flowing from past to present to future. But Dogen sees it from present to past. In Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, Shunryu Suzuki talks about this a little bit. I'm going to read a little passage from him and what he has to say about Dogen's view of time. He says, Dogen said, time goes from present to past. This is not true in our logical mind, but it is in an actual experience of making past time present. There we have poetry, and there we have human life. When we experience this kind of truth, it means we have found the true meaning of time. Time constantly goes from past to present and from present to future. This is true. But it is also true that time goes from future to present and from present to past. A Zen master once said, to go eastward 1 mile is to go westward 1 mile. This is vital freedom. We should acquire this kind of perfect freedom. So from present to past, I'm gathering right now that your gears are turning. Like, what are you talking about? This isn't a view of time that just Dogen shares. the many indigenous cultures throughout our world, including in North America and the Aboriginal cultures in Australia, for many thousands of years have seen time moving from present to past. This is the way of meeting time in a lived experience. We've always in history have looked at time as being a river that flows. Heraclitus, the ancient Greek philosopher who lived about the time of Confucius, said, "No one steps into the same river twice," meaning the river of water and a river of time. So imagine just for a moment that you're standing in a river about knee deep, and the water is flowing. Now, in your mind's eye, turn around and face downriver with all the bubbles and waves flowing against the back of your legs, the detritus, the little leaves and sticks and plants that are being swept right by you downriver. And now tell me, what direction of time are you facing? Well, you're facing the past. In this moment, when we look around, we look at our world, when we meet our world, when we meet others, we are meeting the culmination of the past. It's certainly a very strange way we're not used to looking at it, because this culture, this world, the industrialized world that we live in, the world of capitalism, sees everything that exists in this space and time as the potential for the future. But the future is an idea. We can't see it ever. But the past, it's right in front of you. Now, what could possibly be the advantage of seeing time in this way, from present to past? Well, we can look at many indigenous cultures and how they place an enormous reverence on the objects and the people of their life. And those who have come before them, who are still there, and those who have come before them and are not, are given great honor and reverence. Those who have come before them and are standing in front of them are their elders. The elder, if we think about that, a person of wisdom and strength. Now we look at our way of looking at time from present to future, and elders become elderly. Elderly has a meaning of weakness. If we look at time in this way, then we can turn and see that two heaps of ashes, the embodiment of ending, the incarnation of eternity. In the end, you'll die and I'll die, and we'll end up burnt into two heaps of ashes. And at that time, where will we meet? Where do you meet the appearance of eternity? There is only one place. One place. To close my talk, I'm going to read a poem. This is a poem from a Chinese poet. I have to apologize. I'm not entirely sure of the pronunciations here, but Quan Xu. And this is called Seeing a Friend Off to Shui Kong. Wild geese go like leaves down the sky. How should that be easy for the traveler to hear? 1,000 mountains, 10,000 streams. Where can we meet again? Our faces won't last like jade. Life's more like clouds. If your way takes you to the temple of the third patriarch of Zen, make us all one. Lay an offering by the grave. Thank you. So, I invite you all to make yourselves comfortable. And this is an opportunity to ask questions during a Dharma dialogue, and Alan and I will do our best to answer in any way we can. Rich.
Thank you for that extraordinary talk that really hit on a lot of different things. So this isn't, so in terms of things being hidden, and I'll get to that, no, different. So when you were talking at the end about meeting the past, I kind of developed this technique, and it's kind of accidental, but also with the help of a spiritual advisor, because it never made sense to me, you know, like the ancestors and all that. So now I have like a team. It's like my own team. So my old Zen master is there, Thich Nhat Hanh is there, some present people are there, but they're mostly people who have died. And when I get into trouble, or when I start just thinking so much and worrying, especially about the world, I'll check in with them and I'll ask them, well, you know, how would, you know, like Thich Nhat Hanh, like, what would you do? And it's like looking at my own Dharma, but they feel really real to me in a way that, like 5 or 10 years ago, I would have thought, no, you know, like you said, reading the sutra book, yeah, they're the ancestors, but they really are dead. And now they feel very much alive to me. So,
yeah. Wonderful. Thank you, Rich. I really appreciate, you know, that you're saying this, and really, you know, really are dead. Yeah, really dead and really here. And I would even add that this is not so much a technique, and that it is a view, and it's a way of living, of actually living this way. And it's very easy because the mind says, oh, "Well, you're deluding yourself. This isn't really. These people are gone, and the present is just these dead." You know, and we could go on and on. But yeah, if we can. What could our life look like? What could reality be? What could our world look like if we could see reality like that?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, I was also reminded, Rich, of when Wu Men says early in his commentaries in The Gateless Gate that when we really give ourselves to a koan, we can get this sensation of the hair of our eyebrows mingling with the hair of the eyebrows of the future. And every once in a while, you know, that happens, you feel it. And our ancestors are not just the ones in the dedication, you know, that we read together, but the ancestors that we choose for ourselves. And I think it's wonderful that you're a group of ancestors, and that you can sometimes feel your eyebrow hairs.
Yeah. Really visceral. Yeah.
Thank you, Rich. Kevin.
So the future, if I'm sitting at a table and there's food on the other end of the table, we think that it's like we get up and we walk to the other end of the table to get to the other thing at the other end. But is it more like we pull on the tablecloth and the things come to us and then we eat them exactly where we're sitting?
Yeah, I'm trying to get into your metaphor here a little bit. You know, we're always consuming in the present moment, right? Mm-hmm. So things come to us, things are we reach out for them. That's part of the flow of life, and we can say that we are responsible for pulling the food to us, but we can also say that's how life moves. That's how life forms in this moment. That hunger arises, food appears, life moves, and then we die. Alan, if you can kind of help me out here.
I'll leave it with you for now.
Thank you. So thank you, Kevin. Anne.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. That was a wonderful talk, not least because I'm elderly and I would love to be thought of as wise instead of weak, but being that isn't that. What strikes me often, though, when I hear talks, is when you were talking about the smell of the almond blossom, and he says that you are the almond blossom, so you are everywhere, like this, the smell is everywhere. Part of me goes, oh, yes, that's true. I've heard that over and over again. And part of me says, but do I believe it in my gut? When there's smoke in the air, do I believe that I'm really part of the smoke? And I don't. It's just sort of it's a way of thinking about things. It's lovely and interesting, and I want to believe it, but I don't believe it. It's still something out there. It's just, and that sort of feels like I'm missing things.
Yeah, I have to say, don't believe it. I am not asking you to believe anything. And this is a very, very important point in Zen, in Buddhism, but mostly in Zen, that we're not here to tell you anything that you have to believe. The three pillars of Zen are great faith, great doubt, and great effort. So those equally measured. And so, yeah, keep doubting it and keep looking. Don't throw your hands up and say, I don't believe it. It's the belief. We're here, as Sasheen, as Alan mentioned, to touch the heart mind. So maybe at that level, that non-belief is a lot of the intellect that does crossword puzzles and builds atom bombs. That one doesn't believe this. But there's more to you than that. And that's what we're here to touch. So keep going.
Yeah, in a way, Anne, you're reliving the koan for us, right? Because the first time that Wei Tong says this to the poet Shanggu, he says, I don't understand. And, you know, I don't get it. It's not happening for me. And then later in the mountains, he smells the olive blossoms and he does understand. So you only have to smell that once.
Thank you, Anne. Brad.
The central question in my mind, and I think in the koan, is where do we go when we die? What happens when we die? And we're left with two piles of ashes. Can they communicate with each other? are we still are we, am I still there in the pile of ashes? So that's where I am.
Yeah, I would, that's a wonderful way of looking at this. And I'm sure many, many people heard this and looked at it in that way. I would also ask that, I would say that, you know, the central question is your question. It's not the question that arises on its own out of the koan. You're meeting this koan with this question based on your life, based on how you see the world and see your own life. And that's what we work with. There are other central questions, maybe as many central questions as there are people on this screen and more. So yeah, so that's what we're working with. What happens? What happens when two piles of ashes, where do we meet? Thanks, Brad. Barry.
Where do we meet? Your talk covered so many different topics. It was very rich. You mentioned Suzuki's beginner's mind a couple of times. And there's a passage in there that gives me great comfort about this topic of death. And he describes going to Yosemite and standing in front of the massive waterfall. And he's surprised as he's watching it that instead of it being a torrent of water, it separates into little drops. And he likens that to our lives, that we come out of this great river of being, and for a brief time, we're individualized drops. And then at the end, we return to the great river of being. And that passage is something I say to myself again and again about dying. I'm 76, and I guess I'm elderly. But sometimes I feel like an elder, and other times like a pathetic, elderly, decrepit individual. But I find that whole description by him brilliant and so incredibly comforting. And maybe you meet and talk in the ashes when you're both part of the great river of being and you've returned there.
Mm. Yeah, thank you, Barry. I appreciate you bringing that up. And it's a wonderful image, and I've read it before, and it's always captivated me. I would say, though, however, we don't have to... We don't have to associate that with only death. What about combining into the great river right now? What about combining the little drops of forms that are alive into the one unified waterfall that comes torrenting down from the mountains right now? That's a place you can investigate and not have to wait another 30 years before you pass.
Thank you. I'll ponder that. That's a great point.
And Boundless Way Zen Temple, Corwin.
I do not speak on behalf of the entire Zen Temple. Thank you, Michael, for the talk. It's something what Kevin's story in question actually has kind of hooked me. And so I had some things that have been arising. So I was hoping that maybe you and Alan can comment on it. Yeah, I was thinking that, you know, in life, we often sit at the end of the table and we see food that we want at the other end. And, you know, these are the goals that we find in life. And we have this delusion that we're working towards them and trying to pull them in. And sometimes we feel like that food is being thrown at us. Mm. And, you know, I had the image of the room is doing room things. And maybe that food will appear before us. Maybe some other food will appear before us. Maybe a pile of dog poo. And we won't like it. But it's more about, I think this is also what your talk was about in some ways, is at some point, we will have something in front of us Whether or not we did anything to get there, don't really know. We may have tried. We may have tried to avoid it. It may not be what we wanted, but it's there. So that's what came up for me in sort of sitting with Kevin's koan. So I was wondering what you and Alan thought of that. Thank you.
You know, I hear what you're saying, and it's there, and you're there, and you know, me, the line that respond in accord without laboring. You know, what is arising in this moment, and how it came about to be, maybe not the best question to ask. What am I doing right now? What is it? Maybe a little better. Alan, you want to clear it up?
Well, I don't want to clear it up. I might muddy it up a little bit more. You know what? What I'm struck by in what you said, Corwin, is this idea of the food we think we want at the end, the far end of the table, and maybe something else closer to us. And I'm responding to that in that, you know, I recognize this is something that human beings do all the time. You know, there's this way that we don't allow ourselves to be nourished by what we have, because we think we want something that's unattainable or that we think other people have, and so we've kind of gotten far from notions of time and just more towards notions of how is it that we trip ourselves up so constantly. There's one of the poems in 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird is addressed to the thin man of Haddam, Connecticut, thin man of Haddam. And it's something like, you know, oh, thin man of Haddam, why do you dream of golden birds and not pay attention to the women among you? You know, this idea that the thin men of Haddam stay thin because they don't want what is right there, and they do want something that they think is golden and precious and far from them at the other end of that table. So just responding to that, if what's in front of you is dog food and that's all you're going to get, you know, that's going to be the most delicious dog food you've ever had.
Jenny.
It's kind of related to Rich's comment, but I keep thinking about Alan Watts I read his books when I was a teenager, and he died 50 years ago this year, and in recent decades, so many of his talks are available all over the internet, and I listen to them a lot. I listen to them over and over even, and I'm very aware that I'm the age that he was when he died, and he had produced this giant body of work in all the time I've had. But just for some reason he came to mind with where do we meet, how do we meet, and I mean, I guess we were in San Francisco at the same time. I was a little kid. But I mean, kind of we always met.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. How do you meet Alan Watts? Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen the movie Her, Jenny. But yeah, so in the movie Her, you know, Siri and Alexa, you know, have developed to become these super intelligent AI entities. And they get to know this AI entity that's been made from all of those talks and books by Alan Watts that you were talking about, and they get his voice recordings in. And so there's a virtual Alan Watts who's alive and well and advising, but you know, both human beings and artificially intelligent agents. So it seems as though you found that on your own.
Yeah, I've also seen ChatGPT write in the style of Alan Watts, and it's pretty irritating. But yeah, maybe it'll get better.
So beware of what you wish for.
Right. Thanks, Jenny. Yes.
Thank you, Michael. I'm intrigued by this koan, and I'm also thinking about how these koans function for me, at any rate, as a sort of an irritant, not to say as something that, I don't know, really treads on my toes. I mean, I noticed my reaction to that question, how will we meet? I noticed this sort of naive desire for an answer. And quickly following upon that is, you know, it's all bullshit. It's just a tease. You know, stop it. And of course, as you point out, Michael, you know, it has nothing to do with an answer in the literal sense or with belief. It doesn't matter whether I believe that it is possible for two piles of ash to meet. You know, that's beside the point. And I especially like what you say about, you know, enter the river right now, you know, or Rumi's die before you die, the Sufi die before you die. And that is pointing, of course, to our strange and mysterious practice of Zazen. This is what it all comes back to, I think. But I also noticed that, you know, I followed the koan closely right up until the point where he says, how will we meet? And now I can't remember anything that happens after that. I think it more or less ends there, but I just wiped that out because, you know, he's just prodding me, just teasing me, just trying to get me to give up this habitual, I want the answer, I can't get the answer.
Thank you, so, Pierce. You know, just to give it clarity that he doesn't get it, right? But then later on down the road, he wakes up from a nap.
Oh yeah, that's it.
Suddenly that's understands it. From a nap. And that's sort of to your point, you know, what I really picked up on what you said was your naivete, you know, this naive part of you. That's where the richness lies. If we can kind of look at that and not push it aside and say, oh yeah, that's just me being a Pollyanna and blah, blah, blah. We can look at the naivete and just like see that gold in it. That's where we can learn, we can grow, and we can realize.
That's nice, Michael. Thank you. And boy, am I looking forward to my nap today.
And so before you take that nap, Pierce, I just wanted to say I loved the way you started out by talking about koans as irritants. You know, I like that. And it made me think, I think these are from Woon Men's verses to one of the koans. They're from some koan verses, which is there's these lines, sand in the rice, thorns in the mud. Mm. And, you know, and we read those and we want there to be rice without sand and mud without thorns, but that's not how it works.
Mm. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you, Pierce, and thank you, everyone. Let's all come back to our seated upright position.